This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
It's Thursday evening, it's Nova 1035, and that means it's time for the Business Report. My name's Gary Strubel, and for the next hour or so, we'll take you around some of the biggest stories here in Namibia and Southern Africa in the world of business. Coming up in this evening's show, Conrad Dempsey, the CEO of the First Rand Group, is in the spotlight and tells us about his particular and very interesting story. Our lead story is an interesting story with Transnama, but we catch up with Johnny Smith. And then we're also talking green charcoal. That doesn't mean it's got mold on it. We'll tell you more about that in our Market Watch. And we'll also catch up with a story about trade volumes between Namibia and Angola. And, of course, our regular features as well. Let's start out with one of them. This is the Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm Angie Scholes. According to Simonis and Storm, an uptick in the occupancy level at local hospitality establishments is indicative of a continued rebound in tourism. The Western Cape, which accounts for more than half of South Africa's agricultural exports, looks set for a bumper season of fruit exports. The Angolan oil sector has reason to smile, with export figures more than satisfactory at the end of 2021, beginning of 2022. In the same vein, the historic launch of the very first oil platform in the country will take place next June. And finally, European and US stock markets rose Wednesday after recent sharp losses, but the euro struck a five-year low against the dollar as traders weighed wide. Taking a look at your latest financial indicators, the Namibia dollar is trading at 15.88 to the US dollar, 16.76 to the euro, and 19.92 to the British pound, while one Bitcoin currently costs $58,417.67. Gold is trading at $1,885.42 a fine ounce, while Brent crude oil costs $104.99 a barrel. I'm Angie Scholes. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Time now for the lead on the Business Report here on Nova 1035. And as always, the lead story is brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Our guest this evening in the lead story, Johnny Smith, the Chief Executive Officer of Transnama. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gary, for having me.
Let's start out by just talking about a recent energy conference that was held last week, hosted by Namibia and organized by Rich Africa Consultancy and the Africa Energy Chamber. There was a strong lineup of international, regional, and national energy experts. Included in those list of experts speaking was Transnama. Tell us a little bit about the energy conference and what you guys took away from it.
Yeah, so from our perspective, it was really to give comfort in terms of the infrastructure and where the rail coverage is within Namibia, and of course connecting to the neighboring countries, for the investors to see that that we have that potential in terms of carrying a lot of freight within country, and of course looking at our short, medium, and long-term plans in terms of building capacity from a rail perspective to support the growth through investment coming into the country.
There were also some international presenters. Do you get a picture that Namibia is ready to act as an international partner for energy generation and distribution?
Yeah, of course, Namibia do have unique advantages, especially from a perspective of serving the region, since we do have a small population to cover as our economy. So it seems like this concept of serving the region from Namibia or through Namibia is becoming much more a reality in terms of investors looking at safe haven within the region of SADC to explore those opportunities. And of course, bearing in mind the good infrastructure that we do have, as well as one of the sectors that do carry a lot of that, which is the mining sector.
Of course, with sustainability now being a key word for development, for general economic development, and specifically environmental impact, rail has once again come under the spotlight, and you mentioned now good infrastructure. Let's perhaps just touch on, we've seen in South Africa infrastructure being dismantled at a faster rate than the South African rail network can rebuild it. What is the situation with infrastructure now for Transnorm? Are you happy with where you are?
Yeah, of course, if you look at the two perspectives in terms of the rail infrastructure itself, of course, it's owned by government, but it's at a minor level maintained by us, and all the major rehabilitation projects is covered by government. So from where we're standing, the rail infrastructure can, of course, serve the future, and as government is making more funding available for such railway infrastructure maintenance and development, it will cover our sort of medium and long-term planning. What we do require as Transnorm is the rolling stock to be utilized on the existing railway infrastructure, and of course also better railway infrastructure as we go into the future.
So rolling stock, what is your sort of capacity at the moment? What is your yield? How much of your rolling stock is being utilized currently?
Yeah, so currently we move around about 1.5 million tons per annum. And that we move with around about 34 locomotives that we do have available. So in order for us, our business plan states that in 5 years' time, we need to be able to double up that. So that, of course, means that we need to have more than 80 locomotives within a period of 5 years' time.
So, I mean, would it be fair to say, without pressing the point, that currently you're operating at 100% of capacity and you need additional rolling stock in order to be able to grow that?
Yeah, I would say in terms of the rolling stock, we are actually operating at the deficit level. Okay. So we don't have the, because the reliability of the rolling stock is at this stage less than 60%. So that's a pure disadvantage in terms of the opportunities that we do have on hand for the handling of more freight within country.
All right, Johnny. So it's been a tough old week or two for you due to other concerns as well, and we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on it. Challenge Air was successful in creating an exit for in Namibia. They've now set their sights on Transnamib. Tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, how are you guys dealing with that challenge?
Yeah, we have, of course, responded to the lawyers through our lawyers, although it was indicated in one of the weeklies that we did not respond. So that was completely untrue. Of course, we deal with the matter on the basis that Transnamib has never been part of this. And of course, whatever comes forward, we will make sure that it's addressed in the most appropriate way, as Transnamib will make sure that there will be no such thing as closing up the company.
Okay, so let's talk about something more positive. The Kramsberg line is going to be upgraded. Tell us a little bit about this project.
So for the Wolfersberg-Kransberg section of the line, it is currently being upgraded, of course, through the funding provided by the Ministry of Works and Transport. And with this project, it should be completed towards the end of the year, which then will allow Transnamib to move our trains at 60% of the time that we are doing it now in terms of the number of hours. So currently the train take about 7 hours for that specific route. and it should go down to less than 4 hours after December, which will then allow us also to provide a much more efficient service between Walvis Bay and Kransberg.
Okay, so just for those of us who aren't train spotters, tell us a little bit about what does upgrading a line mean? I'm assuming they're not putting in flashing lights on the rails. What is the upgrade?
Yeah, so the upgrade, it's according to SADC standard. What it, of course, means is that we will not currently, we have a lot of speed restrictions on the line. And also the rail line itself is not, some sections is not in good conditions. What it means is that we can do for freight, we would be able to do a constant speed of about 60 kilometers per hour. And of course, for passengers, we can allow for 80 kilometers per hour.
Sorry, because I am dumb with these things. Does this mean they put down new steel, wider steel? Are the tracks and kind of couplings stronger? Is that what upgrade means?
Yeah, so basically what they have done is with the earthworks or the foundation, they have put a new foundation onto the old sort of structure and have done then new what we call ballast, which is the stones, and also laying completely new rails, which is also a bit wider to be able to carry heavier wagons as well as locomotives.
Okay.
Meaning it's like building a new road, if I can use that as an example.
Going from a dirt road to an autobahn.
That's correct.
Okay. And then just lastly, Johnny, thank you. Is what new projects are in the pipeline? You know, rail's often seen as a forgotten technology, but we see in many of the developed economies, we see rail forming a huge part of future infrastructural development, bullet trains, you know, big links, being able to operate more sustainably than air travel in a country this size. You know, how do we see that happening, linking Oshakati and Windhoek with a train for passengers that would allow for, you know, more efficient travel than is currently the situation? What are the big projects that Transnob aims to work on over the next 5 or 6 years?
So the number one project for us as Transnob is to implement our business plan, which in essence mean that we have to have a full complement of locomotives. So we have just managed to source funding of about 2.6 billion Namibia dollars, which will allow us to do that within the next 3 to 5 years, which would then also improve our service in totality for all the different sections of the line. Some of the projects that we are focusing on in terms of freight movement or to increase freight is, of course, fuel between Walvis Bay and Hobabas, where we will start a new service within the next few weeks. And then, of course, to increase the freight movement between our border at Ariens Vlei up to Lüderitz. And then, of course, linking Grootfontein to the Zambian market. And then, of course, government is also busy, as you said, to make sure that for the medium to long term, that the line between Oshakati and Ondangwa is also put in place. So, some of these projects do take long, but we do believe by having a consistent process in terms of upgrading, eventually we'll get to our dream to move passengers faster between the different stations within country.
And just lastly, Johnny, we are nearly out of time, but what we've seen happen in many other jurisdictions around the world is state infrastructure allowing for private carriage. Is that something that you guys look at? Is it something that you entertain, the ability to put or subcontract to or partner with private carriage on the infrastructure?
Yeah, I think there's two perspectives on it. At the moment, we do look at PPPs in terms of the complete freight movement. As you have a situation that as Transnob We do not really do the loading and offloading of most of the freight. It's either done by the customer or a third party. But we can look at some options, which we have been looking at. But in terms of the total private sector, to allow them to run trains and so forth, of course, that will be coming in the future. The Ministry of Works and Transport, they are busy with a current study at the moment to explore that going into the future. As this is the sort of global perspective, and eventually we will also have to get there as Namibia.
Johnny Smith, thanks so much for talking to us here on the Business Report. That's Johnny Smith, the Chief Executive Officer of Transnamib. And this lead story brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The Business Report Spotlight is proudly brought to you by APS, Africa Personnel Services. We work for you.
It's the Business Report here on Nova 103.5, and thanks for staying with us. Now time for our Spotlight feature, and in the Spotlight feature we speak to prominent Namibians about their path, their dreams, their challenges, frustrations, and their aspirations for the country. Joining us this evening in the studio, the Chief Executive Officer at First Rand Namibia Group, Conrad Dempsey. Conrad, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary, and good evening. Good to speak to you.
So let's start at the beginning. For many people we chat to, Namibia is a place of adoption as opposed to a place of birth. Tell us a little bit about your early life.
Yeah, Gary, I think, I was born in South Africa, in Johannesburg, here in the mid-70s. So quite a while ago for the younger viewers or listeners. And then I was literally a few months old, and my parents decided that what was then the old South West Africa, now Namibia, seemed like a really great place. So my dad was an engineer and moved up to Namibia back then. It was a great phase of development in the country. And initially we moved here for 2 years. It's now 44 years later and we're still here. And it's really just been home ever since.
Studies, you've got a string of letters behind your name. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, I finished high school here in Windhoek at the Blue School on the Hill at Windhoek High, then set off to Stellenbosch and finished the necessary undergraduate in accounting, went on to become a chartered accountant. And I think, Gary, then the world of business really fascinated me. So I really wanted to get into that next layer. Did the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants qualification, which is really a nice business angle towards just the accounting reporting, and then went on to study corporate treasury while I was living in Ireland and finished it through the Institute in the UK. As you sort of progress through business in life, you start to see that it is really a forward-looking science and the way we think about society and the world and the difference we can make. You need to think a bit about the future. And so I then went on to do a master's in philosophy based on future studies and having a view on the future. So, yeah, you do end up with quite a lot of letters, but I think it's really more a factor of curiosity as opposed to any intentional process beforehand.
And that particular area of study, did that change the way you think?
You know, Kerry, I think all study changed the way you think. I often say it to people when they go to university, the biggest value you get is not the facts you learn. Anybody can look a fact up in a book or on the internet nowadays. Mm. It's getting a way of thinking. And definitely something like future studies completely changed the way you plan your life. And you start to understand how the world works and how the dynamic of the things we're experiencing now fits into long-run trends in the world.
We'll get into the impact of those long-run trends on your business in a little bit. But I'm intrigued by something you said, Ireland and then in the UK. Was that as part of your job as a CA that you went overseas?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the great things about a qualification like the CA one is it does open doors globally for you. You know, people from this part of the world, Namibians are highly rated abroad. So yeah, I had the opportunity to go and live in Dublin for a couple of years, which was really great place to live and work. Yeah, in later life, joined a M&A organization in the UK, and then that took me to Australia and Chile, and then later decided time to come home. You know, when the red sand of the Namib dunes flow through your blood, you can't stay away too long. And then came back to Namibia.
So those excursions were largely in the mining industry, if I understand correctly.
That was right, yes. I was working in M&A in mining, and it was during the great boom time of mining. So it was a very exciting time in the world before everything came tumbling down between 2008 and 2010. But back then, it was great. We did fantastic transactions all over.
And what would those have been? Buying mines, investing, buying out?
Buying mines, yes. Simple as that. You know, the world had a shortage, and the world couldn't produce enough copper or zinc or just about anything you need. You know, if you think of it, it was China's great growth phase. And China pretty much consumed more steel and copper than what the entire world produced 20 years before that. And we, as a listed production entity, was the predecessor for what today is Glencore. We simply just couldn't fill all the demand. So our only choice left was to go and buy mines. And you see it today in Namibia as well still. You know, you see the next boom picking up here. And the world needs the supply that we can deliver. And that's why you'll see a lot of foreign entities have a great interest in the country to come and invest. And whether it's developing gold deposits or, well, just about copper or anything that we produce in the country, even uranium is picking up again, you know, because global demand is outstripping supply again on most primary commodities now.
The decision to come home, what sparked that?
Well, Gary, I think firstly it's home, you know, and I think when you ask somebody why do you come home, it's a bit of a basic human decision, you know, you do want to see coming home at some point. The global boom in mining also was cooling down, and I still continued to be involved in global mining for a while. But then my wife and I had our first son, and that first year I was still really traveling the world doing deals on mines. And then you get to a point where you realize, you don't quite know this youngster that's 1 year old now, and you better spend a bit more time at home. And then properly just settle down back in Namibia, and it's the best decision ever.
Okay. Now, leisure time, I understand that you're quite a cyclist. You enjoy climbing hills. Those of you who have yet to meet Conrad, 194, 195? About how close am I?
You're 5 centimeters short.
2 meters.
Yeah.
2 meters tall is Conrad. Do you find a bicycle big enough?
Gary, the way they describe my bicycle is a farm gate. If you put wheels on a farm gate, you've got my bike.
Right. So now one of the cool things about this particular feature is we get to peer into the dark hole of your soul by asking you to select a song for our listeners. What song have you selected for us?
So, you know, obviously when you do this, you sort of come up with a list of 10. So Gary did give me a whole 2 minutes heads up for this. You know, there's a song that I think has just by pure randomness at certain points in my life and my career been there that I really like. It's a song by a band headed up by Eddie Vedder, a band called Pearl Jam. And the song's called Given to Fly. And I think it's a wonderful picker-upper.
Of miles. key to the locks on the chains he saw everywhere. But first he was trapped, and then he was stabbed by faceless men who fuckers. He still stands.
Pearl Jam here on Nova 103.5. We're busy with the business report and the spotlight feature, and chatting this evening to Conrad Dempsey, the Chief Executive Officer at First Rand Namibia Group. Let's talk a little bit about the last couple of years. The banking sector is often the carrier of drama. They benefit enormously when times are good, but they're expected to return the favor when times are bad, and we know all markets are cyclical, as are all economies. A recession followed by a drought, followed by COVID. This would have been a very, very tough time to be at the helm of a banking group that has close to 50%, if not more, market share in the country. That's got to be a lot of responsibility that sits in a debt. Just talk us through perhaps your own journey over the last couple of years in that position.
Yeah. Gary, I think it's been interesting and challenging. But I think if you start to understand the role of a bank in society and essentially as an extension of the central bank on how we transmit value and how we look after depositors in a economy, it's absolutely critical for any economy to function, to have a safe place for depositors' money, and a place that can, in a stable manner, transmit value. And I think if you go back to the 2008-2010 financial crisis in the world, there the world saw that a banking crisis very quickly becomes a sovereign problem. And the world back then said, our banks need to be stronger, and our banks need to be better capitalized. Otherwise, they become the taxpayer's problem. So over the sort of decade plus since then, banks globally, including in Namibia, have done a lot of work to make sure that they've got fortress balance sheets, that when these tough times hit, like we've had now, that we don't become the taxpayer's problem. I think morally it's wrong that a taxpayer need to bail out a bank. And I'm quite happy to say that not just our banking brands, but banking industry in Namibia completely pulled through on the back of very strong balance sheets. Now it's one thing to pull through. It's another thing to also make sure that you make a real valuable contribution to try and help every last customer, business, try and protect the intellectual capital that we have in the country. And yes, unfortunately, not all businesses can be saved. But in an economy like Namibia, saving small businesses does have a lot of long-term value. And if I can, maybe just for 1 minute, just pause on that. You know, if you think, what is the big value of a business? It's not the bricks and mortar and paying salaries. That anybody can do. It's a culture that sits in each business. When you go to your favorite restaurant, the culture that flows through from the kitchen to the staff, the service culture, it's a deeply inherent asset sitting in a business. And once a business closes, that asset is gone. If they open 3 years down the line, yes, they can recruit staff again. They can find a building again. But to rebuild that culture, which is such a good national asset, is gone. And that is why we, and I believe some of the others in industry, have also created dedicated business rescue capacity to try and steer them through. You know, we're a small population, and if you want to have good division of labor, you need a lot of businesses. So, and these things keep us awake. They keep us on our toes. But definitely worthwhile and very satisfying and gratifying when you see a business turn the corner, or you see a household that was deeply in trouble getting back up the ladder and starting to get up again. It definitely makes going to the office worthwhile.
It must be a difficult balancing act often, given the comparative size of market to more developed markets, or perhaps just larger markets from a banking perspective. We have as much banking concentration here, for example, as we do in South Africa with 5% of the GDP. Often what the bank has is this kind of ownership role where its safety net is it can always do something else with that asset if it doesn't get paid off. Or, you know, there's that whole repo environment that exists. But in a market this size, is there a resale? And how do you balance between, because you know you can't sell it to someone else, holding on for too long, and then potentially allowing businesses that should fail to fail, because some should in a healthy economy. Mm. I guess I'm asking a multifaceted question here, but how powerful is that leash that you have in Namibia?
So let me start where you say in the beginning, you know, in a very small economy, and the comparative to a bigger economies, where our levers are very different. You know, when I talk to my sort of colleagues and peers who runs U.S. banks, and their SME section talks about businesses with up to 500 million NAM dollar turnover. So 50 million U.S. give and take is an SME. Now, in our world, it's a very different definition.
Yeah.
So you can't really say, well, because it works in New York, it can work in Vintuk. We've got very different levers here. I think that the topic of repossessing an asset is always hugely topical and something that needs a lot of careful consideration. Obviously, if we sort of start at the top, you know, the bank's role is to protect the depositor's money. And I can say to the depositor, you know, Gary, if you give me your savings and I lend it out to Joe, that, well, Gary, Joe gave us a property as collateral. So if Joe can't repay, I can make a plan to give you your money back. So that equation can hold. Now, that equation holds in a normal, stable economic environment. Where we are now, I mean, we can't go and repossess 1,000 houses. You know,
you destroy the market.
Destroy the market, and you can't sell them to anyone. Mm. Or repossess hundreds of cars, or repossess business properties all over. So,
and, of course, the borrower knows that as well.
The borrower does know that. But I must say, you know, 99% of borrowers do act in an extremely responsible manner. You know, when you sit with a borrower of a small business and you work with them to try and find a solution, they're always keen to work with you and get to a solution, as opposed to trying to bully a collateralized position. We find that quite often you do realize better value. You know, let's say somebody can't service their home loan anymore. By just sitting with them, working through a solution, maybe they can pay a bit less for a while, but stay in the house, or if it might be a second or third property and sell it themselves. It's a lot better value that gets unlocked than taking it to a normal auction.
Sure.
And working with customers, you do unlock better value in the process. You know, unfortunately, for a portion of debt, at some point, it does come to a point where collateral is the only alternative to recover some of the money to safeguard depositors' funds. But it is really a last resort. It's an expensive process. It's a long process. There's better ways to work towards a serviceable position on debt than to just pull the collateral trigger. And I think it's something we see across the market. You know, and that's why we've established business rescue capabilities within our organization to sit and work with the client and say, what can we do here? You know, if you run a restaurant and you can't make it work, it's no use for me taking it off. I definitely can't make it work. So best we together try and make a plan here and see what we can do.
So I guess what I'm hearing from you is it's the difference in a much smaller market is that it's a far more intimate series of decisions and discussions and deliberations that have to happen than pure balance sheet.
No, absolutely.
Or pure spreadsheet exercises where you can just say anyone below this line, take it back.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a lot more about applying your mind and understanding, is this a viable business? And if this business has a chance at viability, how do we get there with the client? Sometimes the answer, quite rare, it is putting more debt in, but sometimes it could be the answer. Sometimes it's just restructuring profiles. There's a lot of things we can do. I definitely don't want to bore everybody with. But it's that first point of understanding, is there viability?
Yeah.
If something isn't viable, then, of course, you know, there's rather stop the bleed, preserve the capital that the entrepreneur still has, and rather help him start something new that is viable as opposed to trying to flog a dead horse.
Let me change topic for a second. And something that that we see a lot of in Namibia are South African-based brands and businesses that operate in this market as local businesses, but still with a wide range of different relationships with either the shareholder or the license holder or however it might work. In this banking environment, what's it like dealing with South African brands and having the as you say, the very different levers in your market? How much of a balancing act is that between the corporate culture that sits over there, the business environment that sits over there, the fact that Namibia is still heavily reliant on the South African economy to start with, the political environment here, and then Namibian culture? So there's a whole bunch of things in that equation, but I'm very conscious that with business your size, that must be a big part of your day, is balancing those various elements.
Yeah, I think, obviously it's 3 decades post-independence. And I think across the board for most businesses that you could say originated out of South Africa, they've to a very large degree Namibianized. I mean, if you take the spa brand, it's a South African brand, but you walk into a spa in Otjiwarongo and it's going to have a very Otjiwarongo flavor to it, from products to solutions and the way they brand and talk to the community. And we see it across most of the major corporates. I think what the South African corporates have also realized is whether you go into Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, Angola, if it works in Joburg, it doesn't mean it's going to work in Lusaka. And you do have to make sure that you are locally relevant, you're locally addressing the needs of society, and you're a good corporate citizen in that space. Otherwise, unfortunately, you're not going to have a very pleasant run there. And you'll probably at some point pack up your bags. And that's whether you're a retailer, a wholesaler, or a bank, across the board, it's the case. Within our own organization, I think what makes us a little bit different is we're almost 50% owned locally. And that's local pensioners, pension funds, and retail institutional investors, which does mean that, you know, you've got a very strong local ownership component. The board is, at the moment, I think 100% Namibian, that sets the strategic direction of the business. So you do find that it's a very nice symbiosis to have that sort of link back into a more developed market and have access to some of the capacity and capability there to really uplift what we can do here, but do it in a way that truly fits into where we want to go with Namibia.
So we're nearly out of time. I've got 2 quick questions for you. If I talk to a banker, I always ask the question. In as few words as you can, tell me your thoughts on crypto.
It's here to stay.
Okay.
I can give you a few more words. I think we're very excited about the technology behind it. I mean, the blockchain technology and what you can do on secured payment. If you just look at the Continental Free Trade Agreement that we have in Africa now, I can literally, if we can get it in place, have secured trading between somebody sitting in Lüderitz and somebody in Zanzibar without all the red tape of inter-country trade at the moment. Crypto itself, it's definitely here to stay. The world's trying to get their heads around how to regulate it.
Reserve banks trying to get their head around.
And the reserve banks
are. They're disintermediated in the process.
They are. And you see a lot of reserve banks launching their own digital currencies now, from the Swiss through to South American governments. And it's just how are we going to apply it for the better of humanity? We're very excited about it. I mean, obviously, in Namibia, it's early stage. We want to make sure that we protect the payments platform and our central bank's purpose to really make sure that the depositors are protected. There's a lot of schemes out there. There's a lot of guys taking chances. But I think, you know, if you want to get into crypto, really think carefully about with whom and how you deal. Because unfortunately, many people have lost a lot of money through these schemes.
Okay. And then lastly, COVID came, it hasn't gone, it probably never will. We now, like any of the other millions of diseases that are trying to kill us on a daily basis, is with us. But the impact will still be felt for a while. In between, there's been some exciting news out of Dubai with green energy starting to become a buzzword, oil being found off the coast. So there's good news, agriculture starting to get a shot in the arm, Nicotel may or may not happen soon. Lots of good news, lots of bad news. You guys are obviously also guiding to a large extent the investment sentiment, given your market share. Give me a break summary of the next 5 years. How do you guys see the next 5 years playing out from your investment strategies?
Yeah, so we like to take sort of a rolling 20-year view. So
okay,
I think five years is just very short. You know, a lot of things that is happening takes longer. But I think it's a very exciting time for Namibia. I really think we're entering to a next chapter. We're really going through the bottom of a cycle that invariably will pick up. It will look very different from the previous cycle. The previous cycle was government funded through a lot of debt that we loaded on. This next cycle is really retilting towards foreign investment. We as an organization is doing a lot to really work with foreign investors, not just to get positive sentiment towards Namibia, but also, you know, work with the NIPDB and other government bodies to reposition Namibia's competitive posture. When you compete for capital now in the world, you compete for it around the world. And whether it is for Agri at Necatol, that same capital can also go into Brazil or Australia. And we got to convince them why Necatol is the great idea. So, I think it's an exciting time. I think policy direction is starting to steer to support it. And sometimes these positive turns gets born out of really tough times like a pandemic, where you really have to make plans and then come out better and stronger. But we're exceptionally positive about the next decade or two in the country.
Well, you heard it here on the Business Report, the First Trend Group, very bullish about the next two decades. Grant Dempsey, thanks so much for joining us in the spotlight this evening. We really appreciated speaking to you.
Great. Thanks so much. And all the best to you guys as well. Thank you.
The Business Report Spotlight was proudly brought to you by APS, Africa Personnel Services. We work for you.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Welcome back. Time to take a peek over the fence at our neighbors who are always up to something interesting. And joining me on the line now is Michael Apple from BizNews. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gary.
Right, so let's talk about the boyke from Pretoria, who's not only got to number one in the world wealth rankings, but has also now managed to pretty much win the internet in the last 2 weeks. And he's also winning by buying. He's gone and bought Twitter for $44 billion. Of course, talking about Elon Musk. There's a very interesting story on the site about that. Tell us more.
Yes, the Pretoria boys high guy who went on to, as you say, bag the richest man in the world title and certainly one of the most controversial people on social media. He went and purchased an initial stake of sort of 5% in Twitter, and then it went over 9%, and And then the stake just grew. And it's initially, I mean, he went from this, no, I'm going to be a passive investor. And then they said they offered him a place on the board. And, you know, it within the matter of, let's say, a week or 10 days, the story really changed. And he went from, well, I'm going to sit on the board, and to, no, I'm not going to sit on the board, to, you guys are useless at running Twitter, I'm going to buy the company. I mean, things moved very rapidly. And initially, Twitter adopting the poison pill approach, sort of making it difficult for a hostile takeover by diluting the shares. And, well, then the news came that the board had said, well, the 54.20 a share that Musk was offering, was it was in the interest of shareholders that they go ahead and accept that offer. So I think if you are the chief executive now of Twitter, you are wondering whether Mr. Musk, when this deal all goes through and finally whether you're still going to have a job based on the sort of the criticisms that he's leveled against Twitter, and saying he no longer believes that it was a space for true free speech. He does consider himself a free speech absolutist, and he wants the town square type feel to return to Twitter. And he even joked, and I mean, we need to be careful here, Gary. When he jokes about buying a company, we need to take it a little bit seriously these days. I see he put out a tweet saying maybe he'll buy Coca-Cola and put cocaine back into the soft drink. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, there was also a fake that ran around from his Twitter account saying, now I'm going to buy McDonald's and fix all the ice cream machines. Yeah. And then he tweeted, listen, I can't do miracles. So even Elon has limits, it would appear. There's a little bit of speculation, though, that he does also seem to be unraveling a little bit. That some of the behavior, and I mean, we watch this from the other side of the world, so it's hard to really know, but it does seem as if he's acting increasingly erratically, and even this transaction could be argued to be not particularly rational. It's really hard to see how the investment case for a $44 billion buyout of a platform that really will always have to some degree some limited appeal is anything other than an emotional decision.
Yeah, it is strange. I was discussing it with my colleagues earlier. The IPO share price of Twitter was, I think, around $44, somewhere there. In pre-market trading today, it's at 48. He's obviously offering the premium of 54.20 per share. So it's a no-brainer. But the share price hasn't changed. Since it listed, I think, in 2013, 2014, it simply hasn't changed. So I just don't know what the value is. And if he's truly going to make it this town square thing. A lot of the criticism is, and I've experienced this in the past, you know, you put a story up and it's about, a controversial court case. Even if it's not controversial, people start attacking you personally. They start attacking your race, your gender, the country you live in, your name, the clothes you wear. And it just becomes deeply, deeply unpopular because it becomes kind of a cesspool of hatred. And now, yeah, people can say, you know, grow a thicker skin. But the thing is, what is the value of the platform if you cannot have any intelligent debate on it? So I don't know. This is arguably what, a quarter, a fifth of his total value. He's valued at what, 200 and, well, it depends what you read, but 250 to 260 billion US dollars. This is a sizable chunk. You know, one wonders if he's going to get value for money here.
We also saw Tesla shares sliding $100 billion in value. So, you know, to some extent, Elon's utterings and mutterings and now actions also have effects that affect basically, I mean, given the size of Tesla at the moment, the entire investment world. Right, let's move on to something a little bit more dramatic. And that's, of course, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, which is now entering its third month. It's hard to believe when we heard the stories Russia was rolling in. It was all going to be over in 3 days. That clearly hasn't happened. Back in South Africa, though, South Africa's done itself no favors with how it's dealt with this particular topic, and it seems its pro-Russian stance, or at the very least unwilling to criticize Russian stance, has been viewed as a real outlier. Here in Namibia, we've seen much the same stance from the government, very reluctant to put their foot in that particular trap. But on the site, an interesting interview with the Ukrainian ambassador to South Africa, who's also herself sparked some controversy by making claims that have been refuted by the government.
Yeah, so Lyubov Abrovitova, I had a chat to her on Monday this week, and it was interesting. She kind of sparked controversy when she posted a tweet a couple of weeks back saying, hashtag talk to me, saying that she cannot, it's been 45 days since my country was invaded and I cannot get a single meeting with any of the South African ministers or counterparts in the Department of International Relations. And that seemed to have done something. While she was initially criticized for this move being pretty undiplomatic, but she said, you know, this is a real war. People are dying. Civilians are dying. She actually went as far as to call it a genocide is underway. And she said, you know, the only way I can potentially influence the situation is by talking to people. And I need to do that by speaking to decision makers in countries. And I need to do that by speaking to the media. And quite quickly after, there was this tweet from her saying she can't get a meeting with anybody. And it was kind of exposing what many South Africans believed our view to be. Because on the 10th of March, you have President Ramaphosa having an online, at least a virtual meeting with the Russian President Putin, where Putin said we were carrying out a very balanced approach. Balanced in which way, I suppose, if you're Putin. But to her credit, Abrovitova, she then managed to organize a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president. Now, it happened more than a month after that initial meeting with Putin, but she managed to set this up. And Ramaphosa said that it was a brilliant meeting. And he said it was a great meeting, and they both spoke about the need for human rights and the need for human dignity and the need for the war to come to an end and there to be this cessation of hostilities. And yeah, she needs to take credit for setting that up, as well as potentially when the war does come to an end, and nobody knows when that's going to be, Zelensky saying Ramaphosa has to come to Ukraine. And once that happens, Abrovitova saying that there's going to be a reciprocal visit by Zelensky, who's become somewhat of a presidential celebrity, if you can call it that, just the way he's handled this war. And I'm sure that'll be a hell of a thing if Zelensky comes to South Africa. But, you know, let's not count the chickens just as yet.
Someone else who became a celebrity pretty quickly, and often we see these things for all the wrong reasons, but this seems to be for the right reason, and that's of course Eskom board member Buzi Mavuso, who was pictured walking out or taped walking out of a Scopa meeting and basically being dismissed by the chairman. But she's not backing down. She's doubling down on her stance, which is of course to not throw the existing Eskom management under the bus. And more vocally, blaming the ANC for the woes, not Eskom, not Eskom's management, not the department, the president, but the political party, the ANC. And of course, that's sparked ire. And it's a very interesting debate that's now erupted as to where does that accountability lie?
Yeah, it is interesting. She's not just the Eskom, an Eskom board member. She's also the chief executive of Business Leadership South Africa. And almost overnight, I'll admit it, besides in her capacity as CEO of Business Leadership South Africa, I didn't even know she sat on the Eskom board, to be honest. Then all of a sudden you have this clip of her, and South Africans love this because there's been such an absolute lack of accountability by the ANC. They love it when somebody in power calls the ANC out and they do it in public. And this is somebody who sits on a board that is in charge of such an important state-owned entity, saying we are not going to take the fall for this, guys. It's the ANC that got us to this point. Now, there was a set of recommendations that the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, SCOPA, they did a site visit to Medupi Kusile power stations in 2019, and there was a list of 23 recommendations there. What mustn't be lost in all of this is that only 9 of those 23 recommendations Eskom actually attended to. 14 were considered incomplete. So SCOPA, you got to understand, SCOPA is saying, we need to hold somebody to account. And Mkuleko Hlengwa, the SCOPA chairperson, actually said, and he's a member of the IFP. He's not even a member of the African National Congress. So it's not as if he has any political interest in protecting the ANC, but he does serve there, many say, at the pleasure of the ANC, and they can have him removed if they so wish. But he pointed out, we're in this situation. The board needs to account to SCOPA. And it just seemed that the way in which he went about asking for that accountability, Busi Mavuso saying that, you know, I'm not going to be spoken to like a petulant child. And we do take accountability for that, which is within our control. But Andre de Reiter and herself and other ESCOM board members were not sitting there at the height of state capture, on a very Gupta compliant board. ESCOM board. So a lot of the decisions, the Medupi Kusile, the deadlines, the overruns. You know, what is fascinating about this is Ted Blum, who's an energy analyst, said that the original quotation for Medupi was 34 billion rand. Then Chancellor House, which is the ANC's investment arm, gets involved. And that quote then escalates to 70 billion. And that is the price at which the board approved that project. 14 years later, and cost overruns of hundreds of billions, Ted Blum estimates that what should have cost that 70 billion is going to end up costing taxpayers 300 billion rand. And that's Medupi. Kusile isn't yet complete. They've moved that date. It's a moving target once again to 2024. And Gary, I'll tell you, I've just part of the need to mitigate against the terrible crippling power cuts we have in this country is this emergency procurement program that ESCOM is running for 2,000 megawatts. And I've just come from a press conference where the organization Undoing a Tax Abuse, OUTA, has said that they're going to be launching a review application against Car Powership. That's this Turkish company. It's a world leader in sort of floating power ships, but it's very controversial in that there wasn't proper port approval and environmental approval given to these ships, which are going to anchor in Saldanha Bay, Richards Bay, and another place. And so OUTA is going to be launching review applications against that. So ESCOM is a mess. It remains in a mess. They still are hovering around 400 billion rand in the red. And somebody needs to take accountability. SCOPA wanted to pin it on the existing board. And just the latest, I see that the SCOPA chairman has said he's going to come out and apologize for the way in which he handled that situation. So he is going to be extending an apology to Ms. Mavuso.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, we remained rooted and fascinated by Eskom. As you know, we're quite reliant on Eskom here in Namibia as well. And so far, our lights have stayed on, but that's only as far as the grid has capacity to allow that to happen. Michael, that's what we've got time for this week. Another fascinating week. Thanks for telling us a little bit more about some of those stories. Have a wonderful long weekend.
Thanks, Gary. Go well.
That's this week's BizNews Wrap. Go check out all those stories and more on biznews.com.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
It's the Market Watch here on the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Time now for a market that a lot of people use. It's very popular on a Saturday afternoon here in Namibia. We're looking at the charcoal industry. And a 20 million Belgian-owned green charcoal Namibia factory currently under construction in Arundis in the Erongo region is expected to create employment for 60 locals and is expected to be able to process and package over 30,000 tons of Forest Stewardship Council-approved charcoal per year and an additional 8,000 tons of briquettes from its various byproducts. Joining us in the, this evening in the studio is Jean-Daniel Goblet and Cedric Schmidt, the partners who've made this investment happen. Gentlemen, welcome to the studio. Let's start with you, Jean-Daniel. Tell us a little bit about Arundis. You've obviously selected Arundis as a site for this investment. The factory is under construction. Tell us a little bit about the decision-making to get to that point.
Okay. Thanks for welcoming us, first of all. We chose Arundis for multiple reasons. The first reason is it's close to the port. And since charcoal is a low commodity product, it gets quite expensive in terms of transport. And because we can transport charcoal in big volumes on double links but not in containers, we decided to get as close as possible to the coast in order to export charcoal in containers from there, significantly reducing our transport costs. We also chose Arundis because it is a very dry and sunny place where we will also be able to manufacture up to 8,000 tons of briquettes every year. So we will be able to dry the briquettes in the sun from there.
And when do you expect this plant to come online?
We hope that within 5 to 6 months, it will be online. And then we hope to ramp up from there for the next year or so in order to get to our full capacity production by then.
All right. Let's turn to you, Cedric. Tell us a little bit about selecting the country. You're Belgian. Before we started chatting, you mentioned that you had put inquiries out into other countries. Obviously, charcoal is a big industry for Africa in general, especially in Nigeria, where there's a massive industry there. You selected Namibia. Tell us a little bit about why that choice.
We work with few countries around Africa and Europe to source our charcoal. We buy from those countries and import to Belgium. That's where we distribute the charcoal to our clients. We work with Ukraine, some countries in West Africa, including Nigeria and Namibia. We've been working with them for more than 15 years, Namibia for 6 years. And the way we were buying was always through suppliers. Throughout the time, we found out Namibia had a great opportunity in terms of charcoal because of bush encroachment. And half of the Namibian country is now covered with bush encroachment, which is also progressing through the time. So our import from Namibia have been growing through the time, and it's been quite hard to do business with Nigeria. And in Ukraine, it's quite politically unstable at the moment. So
that's a euphemism.
Yeah. So we saw a good opportunity into coming to Namibia to stop with Nigeria, where the climate of business is not as good as here, and have our local entity to source the charcoal and export. Okay. And Namibia had the currency is quite stable. We don't see the currency jumping as it can be in other countries. The climate of business is really good compared to Nigeria, and the level of infrastructure is really good. The roads are quite clean and nice. The port is functional. And the partners that we found here are really reliable. That's what we made the decision for going to Namibia.
Okay. And perhaps just briefly tell us, how easy was it to get going, given all of those factors that now play to Namibia's advantage? How difficult was it to get this thing on the road?
Not always easy to invest in any countries. First, we had to go through immigration because you have to go through legal action to enter the country. We explained our project to the NEPDB, and once they found us reliable and that the project was good, not taking any market from Namibian people, and that we were indeed going to employ and create value, we were able to step in the country, create a company, and start developing our network of partners and suppliers. This process has been quite fast and good, we have to say, because Namibia valued the charcoal industry and they saw that we were quite reliable and we want to do the good things in the right way. Developing a network of suppliers and partners, the language barrier can be quite hard. Namibia is a small country where everyone knows each other. It's a little bit hard to enter in the circle sometimes, especially when we talk with farmers. We don't speak Afrikaans, German, or Vombo, or any local language. But once you make yourself a reputation and people are opening to your opportunity, you enter in the circle quite slowly but surely. And Namibian people value good relationships. So once they see that you are serious, they are okay, and it's getting better.
All right, John Daniel, let me turn back to you then. Are you chaps locating here, or are you just here at the moment getting things set up?
So that's actually changing depending on the phase of the project. About a year ago, we were just looking for farmers, so always on the road. We used to make a joke that our offices were in our cars. So that was mostly in the north. This is where the encroachment bush is mainly. And now with Arandis that came up last October, we have been more located towards Swakop, that area. But we do try and part-time in Windhoek and part-time in Swakop now. We still have lots of business in Windhoek with our lawyers being here and some of the essential partners in this entire business. Okay. So yes, we just move around quite a bit, but we will be more and more located in Swakop and Arandis.
Charcoal as an industry is an interesting one. It's got two very clear use cases, one of them being the restaurant trade and another being retail trade. Mm-hmm. Is it a growing industry? Is it still attractive? Is it still something people can look to invest in and build long-term businesses in?
Yes, I think it is a growing industry, especially in Namibia. As Cedric mentioned, the encroachment bush is growing every year. I think lots of people, outside investors, are actually realizing the stability that Namibia has to offer in this industry, because of the infrastructure, the political stability, and the currency that is quite stable as well. So I think more and more people are entering Namibia. So in Namibia, it's growing worldwide. Numbers are growing as well. But it's also very dependent on seasonality. In Europe especially, sometimes we get some summers with 3 months of sun every day, which gets the sales up. And then sometimes it's crappy and it just snows in May and June. So it just, we need to, it is very volatile. But
you
I would
those
say
charcoal warming stoves out there. Then.
Yes. Yeah, maybe. But the charcoal that we do is mainly for braai. That's the main product. So no warming up. We don't use this as a source of energy.
And of course, what's attractive about charcoal in Namibia specifically is increasingly Europe is conscious about sustainable farming, mm-hmm. and many well-established charcoal sources, especially South Africa, doesn't use sustainable forests.
Yes, exactly.
So invader bush is really the key issue, as you say, that's bush encroachment.
So there is an entity called FSC in Namibia. This is also part of the attraction of Namibia. And this entity just pretty much guarantees sustainable production. That goes for the raw products just as well as the human factor, where only specific species of encroachment bush that grow very fast over time can be harvested from a certain length, but also the human aspect where it ensures that farm workers have access to water and shelter and toilets and all of these things. So this is also something that European market demands. There's not much more demand for non-FSC products because we have seen non-FSC farms where farm workers actually live in the bush. They have no shelters and nothing. So we, as a corporate responsibility, we really try to thrive to make sure that the farms that we get our supply from are FSC certified and do meet the regulations of FSC.
Brilliant. Well, gentlemen, the language is a barrier. As long as you can speak braai, you're going to be fine, and you guys are always bringing the fire. So I'm sure you'll be welcome with many braais. That's Jean-Daniel Goblet and Cedric Schmidt talking about a new enterprise, Green Charcoal Namibia, a $20 million Namibian dollar factory currently under instruction at Arandis, and they'll be looking to become operational by the end of the year. We talk a lot about direct foreign investment, and we're talking to two foreign investors who've so far, quite happy with the decisions they've made. That's it for this evening's Market Watch. Stay tuned for more.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
Now, an interesting story about our northern neighbors. We've heard about the south. If we look up north, a country that equally has been through many travails in the last century, trade volumes between Namibia and Angola fell below the desired levels as compared to that between Namibia and other neighboring countries, despite the two countries' relations spanning over five decades. That's according to the executive director in the Ministry of Trade and Industrialization. He insisted that the two countries need to pursue a more focused agenda that will increase trade and investment opportunities between them. Namibian businesses need not worry about Angola's restrictions on imports of certain goods, as decisions can always be reviewed. This was said at a just-ended inaugural session of the Namibia and Angola Joint Trade Committee, which took place in Swakopmund. To learn a little bit more about this, here's Dr. Amu Kakujaho Matunda, an economics lecturer at the University of Namibia, for his view.
Angola should be our natural trading partner, given the distance, given the friendly relations, and given the tackle against colonialism that we really fought very hard together. So now the very painful thing is that Angola is in a way, or has in the past in a way, looked to Portugal and Brazil as their preferred trading partners. But something like this should really be pursued. The Deputy Prime Minister visited Angola sometimes back, I think, a month or two ago, trying to boost trade between the two nations. That would be very beneficial. The other thing that I think is maybe the roads could perhaps be one of the hindrances, but is something worth pursuing for both nations. It could benefit both. And mind you, now that we are pushing very hard for operationalizing the African Continental Free Trade Area, where can we start, if I may call it, at home? Countries that are in SADC as well as countries in the region. And this is a country that we are sharing borders. And by working together, we can achieve big, big, big things in terms of our economies.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
I'm Angie Scholes with your weekly economics wrap. Negative effects of the Russia-Ukraine war continue to reverberate throughout Africa's economies. Coupled by the lingering effects of COVID-19 pandemic, this is adding to higher oil and food prices. Significant price increases and supply-side challenges have been the norm since the beginning of the year. Wheat and other cereal prices rose sharply. With the expectation of higher inflation, businesses have already increased their prices for goods and services. Massive disruptions over the past 2 years due to the pandemic resulted in business input costs increasing by 10% to 15%. Further input costs should be expected this year as the global economy has not reopened fully. Here's Rusa Ndango, an economist from RNB Namibia, with more.
We expect higher fuel prices and higher food prices. And for the fuel prices specifically, we expect those to also filter through to other goods and to food inflation as well, because about 70% of our imports in Namibia are transported via road. Rising inflation is a risk to growth simply because it erodes consumer purchasing power, because it makes your disposable income decrease, but it also increases the input costs for business operations. What we have seen globally is that business input costs have increased by 10 to 15%. And we expect sort of the same trajectory in the Namibian economy.
A Development Bank of Namibia COVID-19 business relief loan of 53 million Namibian dollars has helped to preserve approximately 950 jobs by financing the salaries of employees of Gondwana Collection Namibia. The statement from DBN says that in hopes of seeing the tourism and hospitality sector recover in 2022, DBN Executive for Marketing and Corporate Communication, Jerome Otumba, said the bank is doing everything possible to ensure the industry's long-term viability, which includes a repayment for existing bank customers in the sector, loan restructuring, and the extension of COVID-19 business relief loans to new customers. and a report by local firm High Economic Intelligence reveals that arrivals at Hosea Kutako International Airport increased to 18,496 in March 2022 from 12,678 recorded in March last year. We spoke to the CEO of the Hospitality Association of Namibia, Gita Petold, to hear whether this is consistent with the number of tourists visiting the country.
Things are really looking up. Compared to March last year, we are 8% more, currently 28% occupancy for accommodation establishments across the country and across all categories. It's not quite where we were in 2019, which was the last normal year. In March of 2019, we had an occupancy of 45%. We are exceeding the 50% mark of back to normality, and we're actually 2/3 better for the month of March compared to last year. So definitely we are moving forward, and what is even more exciting is the fact that the forward bookings look even more promising.
And the price of several basic products from Namib Mills increased this week, with maize flour up 3%, Top Score instant porridge up 3.5%, pasta up 5%, wheat flour up 6%, bread up 3.5%, and rice up 4%. The Central African Republic has adopted Bitcoin as legal tender, the president's office said on Wednesday, becoming the second country in the world to do so behind El Salvador. Fin24 reports that lawmakers unanimously adopted a bill that made Bitcoin legal tender alongside CFA franc and legalized the use of cryptocurrencies. The country is the first in Africa to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender. And finally, Chinese lending to African governments fell to a 16-year low in 2020 as the impact of the coronavirus deterred countries on the continent from borrowing. Bloomberg reports that while a collapse in economic growth since the pandemic has strained government finances in the region and increased scrutiny around Chinese lending, the Asian nation is still the biggest single creditor to sub-Saharan Africa. By 2019, it accounted for 59.3% of total official bilateral debt, according to the World Bank Africa's Pulse report. Report published last week.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Another big show here on the Business Report on Nova 1035. Thank you for your comments, for your thoughts. You can get hold of us on Twitter. You can catch the podcast, our handle on Twitter, TBR at Nova 1035. And then you can get onto our website, that's nova.com.na. Check out the podcast. Also pop us a mail, tbr@nova.com.na. Thank you for listening. It's because you listen that we get the kind of guests we do, and we've had some amazing guests this week. Stay tuned for more next week, and also let us know if there's stories you'd like us to cover. As usual, our thanks to our production team, Angie Schultz, our producer, David Bishop, who always has his hands busy in the dirt, and DJ Musketeer, our digital guru who puts it all together for us this week. Travel safe. It's a long weekend. Be safe. Spend some time with the family. We'll catch up with you next week. Good night.
That was the Business Report on Nova 1035. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Struvel and produced by Limey Ilago and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.